This is an institute. At least that's what it said when John Skeet sent me the details, and I think an institute is a place for learning. So I make no apology this morning for the fact that I am going to deal in information more than motivation or challenge. I want to get certain facts and certain statements across to you about the navigators around the world. Now, the best way to do this, because the navs is such a vast subject, would be to, ideally, to bring a staff team from each country and have them stand up here where I'm standing and share what God is doing in their country. The opportunities, the vision, the challenge, the needs. But there are 34, 35 of those countries, and this is not practicable. The next best thing, I think, would be to zero in on one or two or three countries where the ministry of the navigators is distinctly different from the stateside ministry. For example, India, Eastern Europe, Brazil. They would be three obvious cases, and we could go in more depth into those three countries and just give you a feeling of being able to compare the differences between your ministry and their ministry. Well, we don't have the people or the time to do that, and so the third and least effective thing that you've got is me. So, it's all me. And we're going to have time, I hope, this morning for some interaction. I want you to interrupt at any stage if something that I say is not clear or you feel you disagree with it. I'll try and allow a period at the end. We finish, John, when?
Lunch is 12.
Okay. Well, I'll go at quite a speed, but you will have these booklets. And before I give you the booklets, let me show you the three objectives. Warning, my writing is terrible. The three objectives for this morning, purposes. I want to brief you on the nav ministry outside your region, and specifically outside the United States. We'll spend most of our time talking about the ministry overseas. Secondly, I've been asked to explain to you the purpose and functions of international headquarters, which I'm in and Paul Ronker is now in. There are about 15 or 16 of us, headed up by Lorne Sanney, and so we're going to talk a little bit about what they are and how they're different from the U.S. headquarters, which is also on Glen Eyrie. And then thirdly, to familiarize you with a reservoir of information. You like it? It's the first time I've used it. Well, it is a nice toy. to familiarize you with a reservoir of information that you can study later and that can make you be more effective in your prayers. Those are our three objectives. And as we look at the nav ministry around the world, bear in mind the primary aim of the navigators, to multiply laborers in every nation. So we are thinking this morning about the every nation part of that primary aim. And the report that I shall give will enable you to see the degree to which God has led us towards every nation, how far we've gone, how far we still have to go. I've heard Lorne say several times that strategic planning has to do with those two words, every nation. And that's what he's giving a lot of his time to at the moment, and the report will be a factual basis for thinking about that. Isaiah 49:6. Jeannie has my Bible. But Isaiah 49:6 says that it is too light a thing just to go to the house of Israel. God has called us as a light to the Gentiles, that we may go to the ends of the earth. Isaiah 54:2, we have to enlarge and deepen and strengthen the stakes and the cords. So, those are the three purposes this morning, to brief, to explain, to familiarize. What I'd like to do now is just to open in prayer and then give out these booklets, and then we'll go. Let's pray. Our Father and our God, we're very conscious this morning that you are a God who has a concern and a heart and a vision for every nation, and that you have imparted it to us through Christ and his commission to us. And I would like to ask, Father, this morning, that you would use this information, all this data, and that you would cause certain pieces of it to sparkle in our minds, to stand out, to be motivational, to help us as we think of the harvest fields of the world. I would like to ask, Father, for clarity in those things that I say, and that your Holy Spirit would just inform my lips and my tongue that I would present things as you would wish. I'd like to ask for receptive hearts and the ability to absorb all this data and to use it purposefully in the times ahead. Thank you, Father, that we can be together. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, this is an international briefing. If you'll just open up the blue cover, the material in italics there, I do want to emphasize to you, it is largely statistical, and it is, most cases, not set in the context. The context, you would have to go overseas and be with the ministry and talk to the people concerned. And therefore, I want to caution all of us, including myself, that we need sensitivity not to jump to conclusions and not to make certain assumptions when we see that the numbers are small or the numbers are large about the ministry in that country. That is not the purpose of giving you this data. And to me, numbers are just a convenient shorthand for names, and names are a convenient shorthand for people, and these numbers, therefore, imagine the people behind them all around the world. They're just one basis to enable us to ask some questions, not a way of drawing conclusions. So let's turn over to the contents page here, and you'll see I have several main headings in what I want to cover. The peoples of the world, which is the first section of the contents page. We will not spend more than a few minutes on this. This is just a background on the state of the world, how many people are in it, and their religions and so forth. It's the sort of material you need in your filing cabinet, but we will not do much with it this morning. And then the second section is the progress of the navigators. I'll take 15 to 20 minutes on this, because I think this is very important, and I will use some more professional slides at that point. And then thirdly, a fairly short section, facts, basic facts about the Navigator organization, leading into the actual structure of the organization, what our international leadership team is, how the Pacific region fits in. And then lastly, almost a separate section really, on international headquarters. And then we'll sum up and have some discussion. So the first section is on peoples of the world. And we will work through this just page by page. First of all, you see the primary aim there, and then the section on peoples of the world, and now I'm on page one. And this just shows the population of the world, which is about 4.3 billion. You see it there at the bottom of the all people column. 4321. That's the 1979 estimate and is current. 4.3 billion people. And then in the year 2000, we expect that to go to about 6.2 billion people, growing at 1.7% per year. And what I want you to notice, just a couple of things on this page. First of all, if you look in the right-hand column, the annual change, the portion of the world which is, has the most population growth is Africa, 2.9% per year. And they will almost double between now and the year 2000. That is a very significant strategic thing for us in our mission in the Navigators. And let me interject here that our Africa director, Marvin Smith, is on the Glen at the moment. If any of you are particularly interested in what the Navs are doing in Africa, just get some time with him. He'll be here, I think, until Wednesday. So Africa is growing the fastest, and there are 165 countries in the world, and you'll notice, if you look closely at this page, that the countries which are growing the fastest, the areas which are growing the fastest, like Africa and Asia, have a very high percentage of people under 15 years old, and a very low percentage of people who survive until the age of 64 or over. And you can see immediately the correlation there between the speed of growth and the number of young people. And this again is important for the Navigators. Dawson Trotman wrote in the margin of his Bible, as Lila knows, that he wanted a band of young men, and he underlined the word young. And And so we are particularly concerned about the young men and the young women of the world. Okay, enough on that page. Let's turn over. We now start looking at Christians. And all this material has been taken from experts in this field, such as Dr. Ralph Winter, such as the MARC Division of World Vision in Pasadena, and a number of other sources. And their opinion is represented here, that we have in the world 230 million committed Christians. That's the bottom of the left-hand column. And slightly more than 1,000 million other people who, because they happen to live in a Christian environment or because their parents happen to be Christian, put down on census forms and on surveys that they are Christians. That's just their convenient label, but they, of course, do not know the Lord. Parenthetically, I think the figure of 230 million committed Christians is far too high in any sense in which a navigator uses the word committed. However, the men who are publishing this data have a whole number of audiences to service, and they don't want to get into too much of a fight as to the definition of what is a born-again believer. So the 230 million is a very high estimate, but you'll find in the various source books that that is the figure normally given for committed Christians. You'll see that that includes, in North America, 69 million. That includes Canada, and even 5 million, which would be basically Baptists and some Orthodox in the USSR. So we have, looking at that world line, 5% of the world who are committed Christians, another 24% who are nominal Christians, total 29%, leaving 71%, or 3 billion people, who have no pretense to being Christians. They don't even claim to be. And you have there the distribution by continent, and you can see which continents are more Christian and which are less Christian. When you look at Latin America and you see that they are 86% Christian, that will alarm you and probably disturb you. Again, this is the nominalism in many cases of the Roman Catholic Church, which is strong throughout the whole of Latin America and which shows all its adherents as Christians. Down on the second half of the page there, the biggest block of Christians, using the nominal sense, is the Catholics, 59%, and the Protestants come next, another 32%. Most of the independent churches in that 1% are in Africa. Christian religion in Africa tends to be syncretistic, and it tends to split up and form sect after sect and multiply feverishly. There are hundreds and hundreds of independent denominations in Africa. Some are heretical, some are mainline, but they're multiplying all the time. Let's turn over to the next page. Yes, please, John. That's Australasia, namely Australia, New Zealand, and the islands of the Pacific, Fiji, Samoa, and that whole group of islands that lies out in the Pacific from New Zealand. It's far and away the biggest two countries, Australia and New Zealand there, John.
Is Indonesia for a
Yes. The third page, we now begin to break this material down in a little bit more meaningful terms for us as navigators. Countries are not the way that we want to think about the world. We want to think more in terms of nations. And nations are people groups, ethnic groups, affinity groups, the way people group themselves, not necessarily the political divisions that they happen to have been divided into. Over the last century. So here, there's just a repeat on this page 3 of the religions of the world. And notice particularly at this time, the Muslim, 16% of the people of the world are Muslim. I say particularly at this time because those of you who are using the prayer marker will remember that this is the month when we're especially praying for the NAV ministry in the Middle East. And there's a conference going over in Bighorn at the moment, as you know, trying to encourage Arabs living in the United States to go back to the Middle East and minister with the navigators in reaching Muslims. Very exciting conference. First time we've ever done this type of thing. Okay, the languages of the world, the two big ones are Mandarin Chinese and English, and together they total about a quarter of the population of the world, over 1,000 million people. The languages that Navigator staff are ministering in there, if you want to highlight them, Mandarin, English, just tick them off, Spanish, Arabic, German, Japanese, Malay, French. We have a couple of staff in Eastern Europe who are learning Russian, but we have no staff in Russia at the moment, and they are not using Russian as a mainline ministry language. In fact, the people in Eastern Europe would rather you talk to them in English or German than in Russian. Such is their view of the country that dominates them. Further down, the largest concentrations of people in the world at various times over the last few years. This is a statistic which depends on when a country takes its census. New York is still the largest. Mexico City and Tokyo we're working in. We're working in Buenos Aires and Osaka and Sao Paulo and Seoul and Los Angeles. So again, I think we have 8 out of 12 of the biggest cities in the world which have an ongoing Navigator ministry at this time. That list will look very different, by the way, in the year 2000. I think the largest city in the world will be Sao Paulo, the second largest Mexico City, and these great cities in Latin America will be larger than any city that we have in the States, according to the appropriate forecasts. Over the page, to page 4, please. Here again is a way of grouping the peoples of the world. Some of these will interest you more than the others. You can see there in the top left the 12 most populous countries in the world. China now has 950 million people. India, the Navigators are in India, USA, Indonesia, Brazil, Japan, Nigeria, Mexico, and West Germany. On the top right, the 12 most wealthy countries in the world. This is not a terribly helpful way of looking at it, although so many publications use this in so many contexts that I just included it for interest. GNP stands for Gross National Product per head, per capita, and it's a very rough measure of how wealthy a country is. And curiously, the United Arab Emirates, with their oil, are the most wealthy country in the world. The Navigators are in Sweden, USA, Canada, Norway, West Germany, Denmark, and Australia. All of those countries, except the last two, are well above average in terms of measurable wealth. Bottom left, the 12 most urbanized countries in the world. Singapore is just one city surrounded by water. It's 100% urban. Navigators are also in Hong Kong, West Germany, Australia, and Sweden. We have tended, incidentally, not to go for the big urban conglomerations over the years of our history. And we have some reasons for that. And so we don't feature so heavily in these highly urbanized countries, some of which are small in any case. Gaza is treated as a country, you'll notice there. Okay, the 12 most civilized countries. This is a fascinating thing. It came out 2 years ago, and as I point out in the notes here, it's an American organization called the Environmental Fund, and they have looked at three things. They've taken an average of infant mortality, life expectancy, and literacy. And the higher you are in those three areas, the more your people are literate, the longer your people live, and the less of your children die, the more the quality of life that we all talk about is felt to be high. So on that basis, it's not the United States that makes 97 out of 100, but Iceland. Well, it all depends on how you evaluate quality of life, but that's the way they did it. We are in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Japan, Netherlands, Canada, France, USA, Australia, New Zealand. I think we like the good life. Okay, over the page. Page 5 here, I'm using here a way of analyzing the world which was popularized by Dr. Ralph Winter, who is now at the U.S. Center for World Mission. I heard him deliver his original message at the Lausanne Congress in 1974, where he was analyzing the people that we Christians need to reach to fulfill the Great Commission in terms not of what bit of geography they live in, but in terms of their cultural distance from us. And by cultural distance, let me take an example. I'm an Englishman. I come out of a university and a business background in England, and therefore I'm very close culturally to non-Christians who are educated middle-class people living in London. I am similar to people such as yourself. We have a common Anglo-Saxon culture, common language, and so on and so forth. I am somewhat different from our staff in Brazil, such as Aldo Berndt. I am wildly different from the savage tribes living in the Amazon basin. So he has E0, which is very, very close, sort of nominal Christians around us. E1 would be like me working among Americans. E2, me among Brazilians. E3, me among primitive Indians. And the point he's making, which is visible in these statistics, is that most of the Christian missionaries, evangelical and otherwise, are working among people who are close non-Christians. You see the column there? And Ralph Winter feels that there are only 600 million of those who are very close to us culturally and socially, and he is concerned for the distant non-Christians, 2,456,000,000, who are only reachable by people who travel cross-culturally and have the capacity, the missionary gift, can make that leap. There is a lot on this page, and some of it is hard to absorb, but if you just look at the world line, we'll go across and we'll stabilize our view of it by looking at that line. There they are again, the 230 million committed Christians, and then the billion nominal Christians, and then the 600 million who are close, and then the rest of the world who are distant. That adds up to our all people, 4.3 billion. They speak, 5,400 languages. Parenthetically, there are 169 languages in the world which are spoken by more than 1 million people. But in total, including all the tiny ones, there are 5,390. Now we have a new element in the analysis, something called unreached people groups. 16,750 groups of people. Now, very briefly, some of you know more about this than I do, or than it's necessary for us to know at the moment, but an unreached people group is the way that the Lausanne Committee, who are meeting again in Thailand in 1980, have set about analyzing the world. Their view of every nation, like ours, is that it's not necessarily geographical countries, it's not necessarily language, but it is the affinity groups into which people gather. So an example of a people group, in the sense that this column is talking about, would be Koreans in Los Angeles, racetrack dwellers in the United States, high-rise apartment dwellers in Hong Kong, a very specific group of people who have such a shared affinity that they perceive themselves, these are my people, this is what I live among. And so these are being documented, and a couple of thousand of them already have basic data on the computers at World Vision, and this is being analyzed with a view to accelerating the progress of world evangelization during the next decade. Let me just say one thing here. It's interesting. We, the navigators, although we don't use the jargon, we don't talk about people groups, we have acted and ministered this way for years. Students are a people group. The military are a people group. Young married couples in suburbs are a people group. Very interesting. But later they come along with the jargon and the analysis and the categorization, and they say, let's look at the whole world this way. Well, good. There's a lot of merit in that. Excuse me, John. No, they are just 16,000. And you'll see in the footnote that there's another 8,000 people groups in the opinion of Dr. Wagner and Ed Dayton, who are reached groups. An unreached group, if you want to just write down there, is less than 20% practicing Christian. That is their working definition, because they have to draw the line somewhere. These unreached people groups, less than 20% practicing Christian. My opinion, for what it's worth, is that this, again, is quite an underestimate. There are far more than 16,000 of the groups that I've described to you, and they will soon find that they'll have to raise this number upwards quite a bit. Notice the right-hand column there, 37,000 North American Protestant, I left that word out, Protestant missionaries. And that is explained a little bit more on the next page, page 6. We are nearly at the end of the first lap, and I warned you this lap is heavy. It's very statistical. The next one will be more interesting. This page 6 here is a table showing the distribution of missionaries. And look at the North American Protestant column in the middle. The adjusted figure that I'm using there is 35,458, and on the previous page it was 37,000. There are technical reasons for that. Either figure will do, because at the margin it's a bit of an estimate anyway as to what is a missionary. So remember, about 35,000. And then you can see about 7,000 American Catholic missionaries, and about 4,800 Canadian Catholics, another 38,000 Catholics, probably mainly from Europe and Latin America, 5,000 British Protestants, very important, 2,500 Third World Protestants. A lot of attention is being focused on this group, and it's growing very fast. Already 2,500 mainly evangelical, mainly cross-cultural Third World missionaries, people going from Korea to India, or from Hong Kong to Taiwan. And these are the particular group of missionaries which Walton Scott often talks about and is very interested in. And you see there the countries with the most missionaries, and we are in all of those, apart from Zaire, Colombia, and Ecuador. Right. This first section of what I did, therefore, was a general introduction, taking the phrase every nation and just giving you some basic background material on the peoples of the world and the spread of Christianity among those peoples. Any questions relating to this specific section? Yes?
Yeah, that breakdown in page 5, is that an indication on the strategy in that we zeroing in on the ones that are more culturally attuned to us ourselves, or zeroing in on the free countries?
The key, as always in the Navigators, is the right people, the men. And we are accelerating our effort to find out which of us are cross-cultural missionaries, potentially, and really making sure that they get out into the areas where, into the E2 and E3 areas. We have not been adequate in this area over the years. We have tended to go more, well, with the enthusiasm, let's get everyone we can out. Getting 100 missionaries out must be better than getting 50 out. Now, the U.S. division realizes, and all of us realize, that we have more work to do. And so you'll find in the years ahead, I think, that we will try and sort out those who are cross-culturally gifted among us and really make sure that they're put in the right places. Does that speak to the question?
Right. And then also, now, most of the works originate as student works.
Yes. Yes. There are a few countries where we're starting with the community ministry. But even in Africa, to take an unlikely non-Western place, we started in Ghana and in Nigeria with student ministries. Because one reason is that they are, even more than in the United States, the future elite. When I was in Nairobi and went on campus there, I think they have 3,000 students. It's just about the only university in the whole of Nairobi. And one can almost guarantee that those 3,000 students will end up in the top ranks of government and industry and so on. It's a very strategic manpower pool. Yes?
I've done some reading on the United States Foreign Service and also the Peace Corps tried to decide or come up with some characteristic or trait or personality quirk or whatever that a person possesses that makes them, say, cross-culturally adaptable, mm-hmm. whatever term we use.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find one after analyzing millions of people and everything.
Yes.
Except the one that they finally, the only one they could agree on or commitment to the sincerity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That is largely true. I read a book last week by Ed Stewart, who has been the consultant to the Peace Corps for a number of years. And it's an excellent book, by the way. It's called American Cultural Patterns. And you know, if you want to be a missionary, you must understand your own culture as well as the culture you're going to, and then put the Word of God over them both to interpret them both. So I agree, they've done quite a bit of work, but it is a hard thing to do. We realize this, and this is one of the reasons why we're putting such a stress on the IT program. The best way to find out if a man operates cross-culturally is to send him out when he's young and give him a cross-cultural experience. And if he comes back and gets absorbed into the American domestic culture at the end of that, that isn't, quote, a failure in any sense at all. He has just contributed and learnt a lot. And so we want to do that more and more, not just to help overseas countries, but to help ourselves to see which people, as through their traineeship, are the gifted ones in this area. I think although you cannot list very easily what makes a cross-cultural missionary, you can tell when a guy is there overseas, whether he is fluent or not, after a time.
So let me see if I understand your answer.
Yes.
So then as far as the navigators are concerned, the single trait or characteristic that they're looking for would maybe be they send the person over, and if he adapts, then he's got that.
That's a fairly pragmatic approach. That's right. What I was resisting was accepting the idea that there's a single trait. If you'll give me your address and your name at lunchtime, I'll send you Warren Meyer's paper on this subject. He thinks there are 7 characteristics that make for a good nav missionary in the third world. It's an excellent paper, but I feel that I shouldn't go into it now. We could talk a little bit at lunchtime. So there are characteristics. But it's not a case of, would you take this examination paper? If you scored over 90, you should go overseas. We are not taking that approach. It's more intuitive. Okay, I think we should move on here to the second section, which is entitled The Progress of the Navigators. This presentation that you see in this section I originally gave to a group of businessmen who were here at the Glen last January, and I have slightly adapted it, but it is not specifically written for a staff audience. So I hope that you'll bear with me. There are some very obvious statements that I make, which I wouldn't normally take your time and my time to say to you. But on the other hand, it is a fairly useful, short outline of where the Nav Ministry is going around the world. And I addressed myself, as you see on that first page, to 6 questions. Who are the navigators? What is our structure? To whom do we minister? What are the results? How much of it is overseas mission? And I mentioned I wanted to focus on this. And what does this cost? The field is the world. Okay, the first section, who are the navigators? A few basic statistics in there. First of all, what I've done here, my approach is to start broad and narrow down. So the first thing that comes to mind when you say, who are the navigators? Well, everyone on our mailing list. And around the world, we have more than 200,000 people on our mailing list. And we did a survey, Montianga did a survey through the Navlog a couple of years ago, and we found that in the United States, about half of our U.S. mailing list are currently involved in a Nav study group. And then we have about 12,000 people who receive the monthly prayer guide. Over to page 2, or I should say page 8 in this sequence. So we have a mailing list of more than 200,000, and then we narrow down and we have donors, supporters of the navigators, of more than 60,000. And this group is growing around the world at 8% per year. The great majority of them, of course, are in the United States. Then we narrow down even further, and we're coming down to talk in the ministry terms with, which is where you live and work and operate. The basic workforce. The basic workforce that the navigators have, just over 3,000 people. And it's growing at 9% per year. And you'll see on the chart here, a surprising fact to many of us living in the States that the non-American portion of the basic workforce is virtually half of our active disciple makers around the world. These are figures all the way through this portion of the presentation for the year 1977-78, the year that finished 12 months ago. The reason for that is that it takes a little time from the end of our year before the information comes in to me in international headquarters, and it will be October before I could tell you what the information is for this year. But I can tell you, just as regards the USA, since our communication lines are quicker, the size of the basic workforce in the USA has gone up 6% in the year that's just finished, and now happens to be 1735 out of, let's guess, about 34. Okay, 22% of the United States basic workforce is in the Pacific region, which incidentally is a rather typical proportion for the Pacific. If you look at all sorts of things and compare the Pacific with other regions, you're normally between 18% and 21-22% of the American NAV ministry. Okay, then we can narrow down even further from the basic workforce, and we'll look at our staff, full-time professional NAV staff. And this chart highlights the situation there. Again, I have a four-year comparison for you. The staff, the nations, and the countries that we're in. And at the end of 1978, we had just over 1,500 staff. I'm sure you all understand that we include wives in that figure. In 27, of 27 nationalities, working in 34 countries. 1,500 staff, 27 nationalities, 34 countries, growing at 7% per year. It's growing a little faster than that in the USA. In some of the overseas countries, we are intentionally slowing down on staff growth because, Kenya is an example. I was talking to Mark Smith the night before last. We have to be sure that it's an appropriate cultural pattern before we start appointing black Kenyans as something called a representative and taking him out of his profession and so on. It may be that our staff there, by and large, will stay in their secular professions, and that will be more appropriate in the African culture. And our goal is to multiply laborers. It is not to multiply staff. Staff are a means. We're a means. Okay. The next section, the next portion on page 8 here, is this table 3 that's shown on the chart, on the page. And these are the new countries that we have entered during the 70s. And the thing that I want you to bear in mind is that there are 16 countries here, and this was written in 1978, and so on average, we have entered two new countries a year throughout the 70s. So we have really lengthened the cords. And this, as you can appreciate, has naturally imposed some stress, some difficulties in communication, some additional misunderstandings on the Navigator organization and on our communications one with another. We're going to have the biggest test of our ability to communicate that I can think of next February when we bring here to Glen Eyrie the leaders of the ministry in each of our 34 countries for this international leadership conference. There'll be 20 to 25 languages represented at that time, and most of them will be trying to operate in English, and that's going to be quite something. Great conference. So here we are. We've gone into two countries a year during the 1970s, and you want to put some parentheses in your text around Iran and around Uganda. We had to withdraw from Uganda in 1972. Thank you very much. My tone is changing. That's a good idea. We withdrew from Uganda in 1972. We were forced out by Idi Amin, who took exception to us and a number of other agencies, and we have not yet formally gone back yet. We withdrew from Iran in 1977, Jeannie, 6 or 7, for a complexity of reasons. The country leader, Ian Monroe, who was my brother-in-law, Jeannie's brother, went to be with the Lord at that time, and one of the other missionary couples who subsequently left the Navigators was just not too suited to ministering in Iran. So for a variety of reasons, we closed the work down, You can see the hand of the Lord and what's happened since. If we hadn't closed it down, we might have had more people dying or being in trouble. We intend, as I say here, to enter Chile as our next country. Jim Peterson has already made 2 survey trips into Chile. And we are looking around, or he is looking around, I should say, for the right country opener and the right team to go in, hopefully in 1980. One other aside, as you think about these countries, something that you may not realize, you see Austria listed here. Austria is home base for our Eastern European ministries. And we have ministries already in East Germany, Poland, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Romania and Hungary. And what I want you to remember is that in all those 6 countries, we have NAV profile disciples. This is not just a let's go over the border, preach a little, and run for the border again type of ministry. It is a navigator ministry, majoring on man-to-man. And we have profile disciples. And in fact, Jack Mayhall, who visited a couple of these countries in the spring, reported to me that he felt that we had potential staff who would become NAV staff and continue to live in those countries in the years ahead. Question?
Yes, when you say, when we refer to a ministry being a country, what are the qualifications you attach to that to make it a ministry?
In the Eastern European context, you mean?
I was thinking in broader terms.
In broader terms. Well, what I'm talking about is staff-led ministries. So my definition of a ministry is a city or a campus or a piece of geography that a NAV staff man is operating on with a team around him. There are other definitions, but that is a sort of convenient shorthand definition. Of course, we have ministries that are not led by staff, but which we have made an investment in and continue to have a strong interest in. But that's the simplest way. Yes? Mostly orphans, and it would be untypical in that. In other words, our primary ministry there is strengthening the believers, not leading new people to Christ.
Is most that going on with the disciples?
Yes. Yes. Jerry.
And those primary people we're working with, as I understand, Paul,
yeah,
would be what we would categorize as phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But they are reading out are coming to Christ
yes.
In that next generation.
Jerry, do you use the word orphan and adoption interchangeably?
Yes.
Okay.
We would normally use the word adopted.
Yes.
The
preference
of the word orphan,
right? Yes. Yeah. Okay.
No, an exception to that would be Yugoslavia, where Dick Fisher...
It certainly would. Yes. Yugoslavia is halfway between the West and the East in terms of the freedom that you can get in there. And we have staff in Zagreb, and we are placing contact staff such as yourselves in Belgrade, capital of Yugoslavia. They'll soon be there. So that's a semi-open or semi-closed country, and quite a ministry there. Okay, section 2, still on page 8, our structure. I make the comment that to lead and to stay together as a global team is a complex operation. And see the top of page 9 here, the mission agency is a sophisticated, printed page 3, McGilchrist page 9. A mission agency is a sophisticated structure. It has to accommodate professionals, that's us, and many, many volunteers, that's the basic workforce. There's no net profit accountability to tell you at the end of the year how well you did in concrete terms or how poorly you did. And what I call our market situation, with tongue in my cheek, which is a business term, changes very rapidly. We get thrown out of countries, doors are opened by God, we can get into new countries, the visa situation changes, the whole of the turbulence politically of the world is very volatile and getting more volatile. And so that second paragraph, I think, is an important one, which most of us, or we all realize, we demand a high level of interpersonal interaction to stay on track and keep our hearts together. It can't just be done by memos or by letters or by occasional visits. The third paragraph, from my perspective at least, we are very decentralized. The team in each country writes the plan for the ministry in that country and executes the plan. A copy, a short version of the plan, comes here, and we look at it, and we find out what they're doing, and we see if we can help them. Maybe Lorne should visit them, or one of the USRDs should visit them. But the operation is very decentralized. In fact, to my mind, it's a little too decentralized, and that's why we are working at the moment on a strategic plan. We've got bottom-up planning working rather well. Our top-down planning is in its early stages and needs to be a little bit more developed. But the way we do it at the moment is quite simple. Let me make a statement here. The central problem, the best way to look at it, is this. We want to be a global team. That's the hypothesis. So the problem becomes, how do you link one man, one president, Lorne Sanni, with 34 countries? And when you think of the problem that way, all the hierarchy falls into place as being secondary and flexible and merely an enabling linkage to link one president with 34 countries. Okay? So we have this interconnecting hierarchy, and basically it is the divisional directors of the four divisions and the overseas regional directors and the stateside regional directors too, because it's a little uncomfortable just to treat the United States, which is so big and so prolific, just as a country the same as Kenya. So that's always a sort of tension in the presentation that I'm making. If I had more time, we'd go into the U.S. structure in more detail. So our basic international structure is Europe, Middle East, and Africa, led by Jim Downing. Latin America, led by Jim Peterson out of Campinas, Brazil. PAN, Doug Sparks has just taken over, and the probability is that he will locate in Singapore. Other possibilities are Baguio in the Philippines and Hong Kong. So Singapore is the most likely. The United States, Colorado Springs. And then to help Lorne, the International Headquarters Group, which we'll be talking about later this morning. You see the number of countries there, five regions in the case of the USA, and the number of staff, and still the strong preponderance of the domestic U.S. Staff. over to page 10. Interesting fact here, 13 of our 34 countries already have a non-American leader, not always of that particular nationality, but at least we can see that more and more we are introducing non-Americans into the leadership structure of the navigators. Egypt and Jordan each have an Arab country leader, as you see there, Nabil Jabour and Issam Khoury. Both these men are on the Glen this weekend, and if you're interested in the Middle East, try and get some time with them. Okay, section 3. Our traditional emphasis has been on the military and student ministries. I've mentioned that. Here's the number of ministries we have. No, sorry, we've done that one already. Forgive me. This is the chart slide. We have 533 ministries last year around the NAV world, and my definition of a ministry is a location with a staff member in charge of it somewhere in the world. And you see the historic student ministry still slightly over half of our work, and then the community, which is the fastest growing sector, both in the United States and overseas, has just overtaken the military, and 500 in total. Of course, in the U.S., the military would still be ahead of the community because there's almost no military ministry outside the United States, apart from American forces. Yes?
That was my question.
Okay. Yeah, that is a composite of dissimilar situations in the USA and overseas.
I have another question. Is there some reason for that? I mean, are we working in the British military?
Cherry, why are we not working among non-American militaries?
The philosophy we are in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Dave has
it's true.
The ministry in Singapore. primary reason is there's no other country except China and the USSR that has a proportion of people in the military such that it would warrant a full-time ministry. Now, I know that Tony Bryant is already doing a back-end ministry to the RAF.
Yes.
It's hard and interest. But only Singapore has that accessibility, and there's a small proportion.
Yeah. Okay?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, turn over to page 11. I think I'll go a little faster still because I want you to see these charts halfway down page 11, the section on the results of our ministry. And this slide shows you the measurable fruit of the NAF ministry of, you remember, evangelizing, establishing, and equipping. And the three outcomes are converts, disciples, and disciple makers. And you'll see that in the year 1978, around the world, 8,800 new converts, 3,200 new disciples, and about 800 new disciple makers. For reference, the United States in that same year had 1,914 out of the 3,200 disciples and 438 out of the 800 disciple makers. In both cases, between 55 and 60%. Okay. And then I make some comments here about other subsidiary ministries, like the publications ministry and the conference ministry that we're enjoying at the moment. And then over onto page 12, how much of this is overseas mission? And 300 of our 1,500 or so staff, that is around 20%, actually work as missionaries outside their own countries. These are the people who have to be transcultural. And in the early 70s, the percentage used to be a little higher. But we were trying to grow faster than the Lord wanted us to grow, and some of the people who went overseas were just put into locations where they were not functioning effectively. And so the percentage is a little lower now, but the success rate is higher. You know, I list these five countries here, Australia, Britain, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Singapore. That is where the non-American strength of the Navigators currently lies. About half our workforce and over half our income from outside the United States comes from just those five countries. These are the countries that Lorne Sanni gives a lot of attention to, that we want people such as Jack Mayhall to travel to. We are very concerned that they grow as fast as possible, and as they follow in the track that the USA blazed years ago, that they learn all they can from the American navigators. These are sophisticated countries. They're not frightened of Western methods. They have similar problems to the problems that the U.S. has. They have constitutions, they have boards of directors, they have the equivalent of the IRS. They have all these things which a NAV country leader often finds difficult to handle, and where the U.S. can help them, and where I am trying to help them also. Okay, you see the statement down there, the end of section 5. We sent out 37 staff missionaries last year, and this year I calculate that we've sent out 55. The major increase has come in ITs. Of the 55 new staff missionaries we sent out in the last year, 26 are international trainees. And that number is going up all the time. Parenthetically, let me just tell you that within the next 12 months, there are 74 overseas assignments, the great majority of which Americans are suitable for, available without a candidate overseas. So if we cut it down, we say about 60. At American slots, some like India or not. There are about 60 overseas assignments open to Americans, which the overseas country leaders would like to fill within the next 12 months. So this curve of more and more sending of missionaries, which the USA is entering and accelerating on, just keep it up and go faster. There are plenty of opportunities in the next 5 years, which is as far ahead as we can see. We will not run short of overseas opportunities. Now, I emphasize this because you read the news media and this anti-Americanism and the day of missionaries has passed. That is junk. It's junk in the navigators anyway. There are almost unlimited opportunities for American missionaries. And this is where Jack's heartbeat and vision is and what I'm sure he'll be sharing with you this afternoon. Okay, what does our ministry cost? Just a glance at that. The first table at the bottom of page 12 here is a gift income. Gift income in 1977-78 was $12.6 million. It is increasing at just over 20% per year. The green portion is gift income from the USA. The yellow portion is from outside the USA. And then, traditionally, once we have the income, we set about spending it. And a chart on annual expenditure. Now, difference in the ratio between yellow and green. And the reason is that a lot of American money is going overseas. American gift income is going overseas and is being spent overseas. So much more is being spent relatively overseas than is being raised overseas. $6.1 million is spent outside the USA by American missionaries and by nationals, whereas only about $3.6 million is actually raised outside the USA from non-Americans. And the point here about the difficulty for an American operating overseas now with the value of the dollar and inflation. So, just a little summary on this section. Some of the key statistics that I have given you on the paper here and on the charts. Hooking them all back in to the vision of multiplying laborers. The ministries we have, the staff we have, the money we have, the results we have, the missionaries we have. All of these for the year 1977-78. John.
How are we able to spend more than
that? That's a good question, and the answer is as follows. Our expenditure was $15.4 million, and our gift income, which is your point, was only $12.6 million. Onto the gift income of $12.6 million, we should add $1.8 million for publications, $0.8 million for conference fees, and $0.2 million for miscellaneous other income. Should come up to 15.4. So it's an apples and pears situation, but I'm glad you spotted it. Yes?
Are you aware of any moves within Congress or anything of this nature to limit the amount of American capital that can go out of the U.S. in a missionary capacity?
No. There are a number of moves in Congress to make it more difficult to raise money in the States. More regulations, more declarations, and so on, but not to export it. No. Okay, that concludes the major section. And the next section, facts about the navigators. I do not have any slides on this. We will just walk through these pages so that you're familiar with what's on them. This will take us not more than 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'll spend my last 7 or 8 minutes on international headquarters. So we're now on page 14, basic facts. This is another permutation of the data that I've been using. It shows you the staff, the languages used by our staff, the countries that we're in. Notice I put Poland down there as a country. I haven't been consistent. I come right up front and say we're in Poland with staff, which we are, and then I get reticent and say we're in South Asia, which of course is India. I got my audiences mixed. We're in India. It's difficult when you do something like this to switch from audience to audience. Okay, we have 14 countries that have sent out at least one representative. And Brazil may surprise you. The person I'm thinking of is Fernando Gonzalez. He is he's a Colombian. He is a Colombian ministering in Argentina with his support coming mainly from the United States and Brazil. So he's a real transcultural specimen. And this established ministry, I have a loose definition of this. The definition is not important. What we need to remember is these five overseas countries in the USA with, of course, the USA being far and away preeminent, the sort of powerhouse for our missionary thrust in the 80s. And then the NAV ministry there, basic workforce, the donors, the gift income, the expenditure, and as John was asking, there it is, $1.8 million for NAV press, and the... We have 22 NAV countries which sell materials. NAV press is not 1.8 million. Last year it was more like 1.3 million. $500,000 comes from other countries. Go to page. This is a ferocious sheet, isn't it? This, all you people who like people and don't like numbers, this Global Performance Primary Series. I'd like you to believe me when I say that the IOT use this, and now that I've worked with them using this chart for 3 years, they understand it. But I don't think we'll accomplish that within a couple of minutes. But just look down the right, left-hand side. These are some of the things that the International Leadership Team every December like to look at on a global basis, to look at trends. Obviously, new disciple makers, because that's the objective, multiply labors. Obviously, the basic workforce, because they're doing the work. And the reps, the donors, the income, the expenditure. And this is set out for the 1970s. And by the way, 78, 79, the first indications I have has been an excellent year in most branches of the measurable ministry. Okay, turn the book around again, page 16. You can look at this sheet at your leisure. This shows the share of various aspects of the NAV ministry which is held outside the USA. Let me take an example, third one down, new disciple makers. There are 438 new disciple makers in the USA, 359 outside, total 797. Therefore, 45% of the production of new DMs last year was non-American. So you can see where the non-Americans are strongest, and you can see where they're weakest, which, as you would expect, is largely financial. A lot of the non-American countries just have no possibility of getting up to a relative equality in their financial base. But their budgets are lower, so there are countervailing factors. And then the missionary data there. Okay, over the page to page 17. Those of you who are interested in the development of our staff over the last quinquennium, the last 5 years, see along the top line, it's now reached 1,560 persons, and from 935 back in 1973, and I analyze it in these ways, which I find useful, by position, by country, by nationality, by sex, by home or overseas, and by ministry. Look at the very last line on the page. I want that to be noticed by you. All, or the last line of the table, all percentage O stroke S. That is the percentage of the entire NAV staff which are ministering outside their country. And it backs up the remark I made that in the early 70s we had a higher proportion out, namely 29 and 28%, but we had a higher failure rate too. Now we're operating at about 20%, and the productivity and the morale of the people who are missionaries and just everything is going much better. We overextended ourselves as we went into those two countries a year. 20% of our staff overseas. Page 18. Here is the annual expenditure budget globally of the navigators. You'll see there in the right-hand column halfway down, last year it was $20.4 million. Again, John, for your benefit, because you like figures to add up, obviously. I do have an explanation as to why the budget is 20 and the expenditure is 15. We'll talk later. by category, the budget, American missionary staff. Praise God for that. $3 million, 3027. $3 million of American money is going overseas in support of American missionaries. That's $3.5 million, I expect, this year. This is a year old. That is a tremendous investment in men of U.S. money. It's fantastic. As a non-American, it just eats me up to see that. It's terrific. I wish we could, get more speed up in Britain. And then the money that's going to other missionary staff, national staff, and so on and so forth, right down the page. Notice the offices there, 10.9%. It's a little loose. What is an office? What is administration? But basically, our administrative thing is about 10 or 11% of our expenditure budget. Over the page. Another blue sheet greets us. Organization of the navigators. Turn it sideways. And here you see an organization chart which shows the four divisions that I showed you on the slide, and the regional directors who plug in to the DDs. Look on the right-hand side, there's Cherry, Pacific, and then the state directors underneath, and that's about all that I have room for on this single-page presentation. But the attempt here is to show the organizational structure of the navigators. This is a current chart from 1 September. It was, as far as I know, the right people in the right columns. And some of the... So, and you see the IHQ up there, the I'm Sanchez and McGilchrist, and then the three headquarters men on the Glen here for the USA, Sheffield, Bridges, and Sargent. Or three of the men, I should say. The three men who report to Jack. That's the distinguishing feature. That's why I put them on and not the others. Over the page.
Question.
Yes.
Do we only have one vice president now, Donald?
Yes. Well, sorry, Paul.
Didn't Jack have...
Jack has Bob Sheffield on the U.S. Board of Directors, but I'm not sure that that automatically makes him a vice president. Perhaps you know...
That's a corporation. In other words, you have to legally have a on the corporate board by regulation, and so they, you know, like Jerry Wrigley's, and that is also the Secretary of Labor.
Yes.
So it's a...
But are Jerry and Chef vice presidents or just board members?
Chef was the vice president this year. They kind of passed us.
Yeah. The one who really needs the title, as Paul knows, is Rod. If you're a fundraiser, you need a handle. And that title is very useful. We're on page 20 now, and we just leave on one side the USA now. This sheet describes the purpose and functions of the International Leadership Team. And the International Leadership Team is made up of the four divisional directors, which you saw in the chart, plus the deputy president, Leroy Imes, at the moment, and myself. And they meet twice a year in April and December here at the Glen. And our functions are to do these seven things. Now, occasionally I hear someone say, they don't take many decisions. That's right, we don't. And we're glad we don't take many decisions because we are decentralized and the decisions should be taken locally. And our attempt as a team is not to take decisions for everyone else, but to do things like these verbs here, to clarify, to teach, to develop, to recommend, to identify. And so you need to evaluate something like the International Leadership Team by what it says it's trying to do, not by what you thought it was trying to do. And I'm glad that there is this measure of decentralization. Number two is very important for Lorne and the DD, is to teach the conceptual and spiritual bases for our ministries. Number three is my particular interest and concern. Number four also. And to a degree, number six. And there's a distinction there. Down the bottom under relationships, this team, the ILT, advises Lorne in the ministry leadership of the navigators and therefore is mainly line leaders. Basically, they all are, apart from me. The IHQ, its international headquarters, advises Lorne in the administration of the navigators. Therefore, it follows that it's mainly staff specialists. It gets confusing, IOT, IHQ, all this jargon, but that is the very important distinction between them.
I'm not trying to be facetious, but number four, to recommend and enforce global policy. Just wondering about your choice of the word enforce.
We talked about that last December, and it used to say to recommend and apply or something. The divisional directors said that if we were going to have any global policies at all, they felt the burden to enforce them, and they asked for that to be written in. I would have taken a more relaxed posture on that. But you're right. That's more than clarifying and recommending. Yeah. Yes. We don't normally bring the whole ILT together for a meeting like that, but there'll probably be a meeting within the EMMA division if there was a problem in the Middle East. I was in Beirut in October 74 when the war broke out and we had to evacuate, and I came out with Vedana and the others. But the thing is so localized that you don't have time to fly. If you could fly to London and have a meeting, you wouldn't have a problem. Your basic problem is, can I get out of the country? In that sort of situation, not should I have a meeting and decide what to do. And so the answer is there isn't much of that. Now, the meetings that we have here would be prayer meetings. communications network, and we do know, and we spend a lot of time in the IHQ building praying when these crises crop up. Page 21 is a statement of five international projects that the navigators currently have. These are decided by LAWN and the ILT, and they are defined at the bottom of the page. The FOM, I should categorize, I suppose, as 90% finished. Leadership and management, about 60% finished. Doug Sparks did a lot of the groundwork on that, and Jerry was on the task force too. The leadership conference next February, Leroy is in charge of. The year of prayer, I hope you've noticed some of the impact of that, Ken Schott is working on. By the way, there will be a worldwide week of prayer, 1 to 6 October, for the NAVA ministries around the world. Lawn's mentioned it in his dear staff letter, and the material will come out quite soon to you. And then a project on missionary selection, orientation, and supervision. I took it temporarily. Jack is now taking more of it, and I think he'll have something to say about that this afternoon. Jerry, could I take another 8 minutes till 10 past?
15, Donald.
15? Okay. I ought to slow down a little bit on international headquarters. It's not that we're more important, but that it's more difficult to communicate, IHQ. Okay, our last blue section here. Specifically, John Skeith asked me to explain what international headquarters is and how it differs from the U.S. headquarters. I am going to give out, or I'm going to ask two of you, please, to give out these brochures, which are brochures describing international headquarters. This brochure, which to me as a non-American is a rather glossy, high-grade sort of product, was designed for our American donors, and we have been using it at IHQ banquets in Colorado Springs and elsewhere. We have been using it in mailing it to those who already support us, and in a variety of promotional ways, because the International Headquarters team happens to have a specific commitment this year and next year to try and stand on their own feet financially and not to continue to be dependent upon the American where needed most fund. And so this, we felt, was a vehicle whereby we could present to lay audiences, not to staff, of course, to lay audiences what we were trying to do. And it's written in ministry terms and is, I think, a very successful piece. So that's for you to take away with you if you've not seen it. We'll start in here on page 22 briefly. The mission of IHQ. First of all, Sani's purpose, Lorne Sani's purpose, he defines as to guide the navigators towards accomplishing their aim and their objectives. Psalm 78:72. To function adequately, Lorne needs a staff team around him. And that simply is what IHQ is. We are not line leaders. We are a group of staff specialists, and so we define our mission not as to guide, like Sani does, but down the bottom of the page, as to serve. We serve the president, the IOT, and the NAV staff. Okay, over the page. I expand on that a bit. There it is again, the purpose, to serve Sani, his leadership team, and NAV staff. And we have 9 functions in international headquarters. And to support and help Sani comes number 1. To help the ILT to operate effectively. To coordinate the movement of resources around the world. And we found this to be very essential. It's not a question of antagonism or difficulty, but in a particular situation where you have, an American missionary in Kenya, you have the Kenyan country leader, you have the American sponsoring RD, the Kenyans themselves are interested in what the missionary does. The divisional headquarters in London is also interested. And there is a lot of coordination. And so IHQ try to take upon themselves this function of facilitating the international movement of staff. And to a degree, money. But basically, we don't move too much money internationally. Spontaneously, some $600,000 a year is given by people of one nationality to another, incidentally. That's an amazingly large sum. But we do not orchestrate that. We do not say, would you please start giving to Koreans, you people in the Pacific region. We've done very little of that, and we are nervous about it to a degree. Spontaneously, it happens to the tune of $600,000. Okay, back to the purpose and functions here. Fourth, to take initiatives in the light of international needs. An example of that would be the type of initiative we've taken with the Year of Prayer. It's an indisputable need. We felt an upsurge of the Holy Spirit speaking to many staff around the world at the same time, and so we've just brought it into focus. We haven't dictated it. In a sense, we haven't organized it. We have just provided some materials and some focus. Five, to stimulate and disseminate the benefits of international projects. I showed you the five of those a couple of pages back. To stimulate administrative clarity and internationally appropriate systems. That, of course, is an area which I'm interested in. How can we come up with transcultural systems, and the simpler the better. To provide specialized ministry services. Example, we have Leroy Imes in IHQ, and he's an evangelist. We now have George Sanchez again, starting 2 weeks ago. Praise God. And he is a counselor and a number of other things as well. So we have these specialized ministry men available to help the staff around the world. Number seven, number eight, to resolve frictions and meet emergency needs. We would like, as it were, to have a what I could call a spare divisional director available, someone like Leroy Imes, who if Jim Downing has taken ill or anything else of that nature happens, that we do have the ability to meet emergency needs. Jim Downing's health, by the way, is excellent. Perhaps I shouldn't have said that. Of course, I had in mind his heart operations earlier in the year. He's recovered very well. Number nine, to promote unity of heart and purpose between our countries. So that are the nine things at IHQ. And as you meditate on that, or think about it anyway, you will see that they are different in kind from the sort of things that U.S. headquarters does. And so there is a very, we're all together on the Glen, and most of us are Americans, so it's hard to pull them apart. That's why we need to look at something like this, say, ah, yes, that's a different kind of operation. IHQ is to help Sani do his job better. U.S. headquarters is to help the American staff function effectively in their operation. Yes?
It seems from this then that your interaction is primarily with the country leaders and not, say, the individual grassroots missionary.
Unfortunately, yeah. Yes. I was asked to give a presentation on, I was asked by, you have something in your folder. And the simple question was, would you please write down, Donald, what IHQ does for the Pacific region? That's an embarrassing question. And my answer is, not very much. But the reason is that we are working on two types of NAV staff, with two types. We're working on leaders of staff, and we're working with missionary staff. And most of the people in the Pacific region are not leaders of staff or missionary staff. So we're zeroing in there. And not only leaders of staff, but RDs and DDs and so on. See what I mean?
Yeah, except now, but as far as the actual overseas, mm-hmm. primarily with the country leaders?
Primarily, it depends on the maturity of the country. Like when Lorne goes to Kenya, he'll meet with all the staff and all the basic workforce.
Right.
And, you know, they'll probably all get in one room and have a ball together. But, you know, if you go to Britain, then he'll meet with the leaders of staff. So it depends on the circumstances. Okay, page 24 is our organization chart in IHQ. And Sani has two personal staff. He has Millie Hopkins as his secretary, and Dave Horsgraf is a personal assistant. And then three men who report to him, Leroy Imes, George Sanchez, and myself. And you can see that most of the running of IHQ is attempted by me, because I have most of the staff under me. And we have a conscious objective. We don't want Lorne to run international headquarters. We want it to run just by itself under my guidance, and to be a service to him, not an extra responsibility for him. And so that's why most of the people report to me. And Leroy has responsibility for the ILC. You may not know that Jody Baker is coming down here for 6 months, and she's there on the chart reporting to Leroy on the ILC. Over the page to 25. Read this at some other stage. Recent history of how IHQ evolved and separated itself from the U.S. And why it has been difficult to separate them. Page 26, the current situation. And a little bit more definition in words of what IHQ is trying to do. Then over to page 27. One of my personal goals is that the budgeted cost of the international headquarters team, which is now 17 people, should stay within 2% of our global budget. And if you can see quickly on these figures here, budgeted expenditure, 1978-79, about seven lines down, we blew it. 2.5% of the global budget. This, for the next year, we forecast that we will get back to 1.9%. The reason that we blew it is that we had Doug Sparks attached to IHQ as a divisional director, and we had some special costs related to the leadership project, and Rock Bottomley, and Bob Stevens, and some others who have now left IHQ. But as a first goal for me, I want to keep that under 2% of the budget of the navigators. It ought to go even less. But so what this shows is the actual expenditure and the gifts designated. Look at that line, subsidy from US WNM fund. That's what I thank you for praise God for. We've had to depend over the years on a subsidy from the American Where Needed Most Fund. And the trend of this is downwards as we develop more fundraising. We're working hard on designated support, each of us now. I'm supported by donors in seven countries, but most of the other people are supported by donors just in the States. And we are going much harder after designated support because the U.S. has administrative needs and problems of its own, and we want not to have to cause them to have to transfer $100,000 a year, as you see there, out to pay for IHQ. That's one of our three big objectives within IHQ this year, is to stand on our own feet. Page 28. If you wonder what all of this costs, these 17 people, there it is, 62% of its salaries, 6% benefits, 10% ministry expenses. We pay an administrative charge of 15% of our budget for the privilege of using a building on Glen Eyrie and using word processing, photocopiers, and all the other services that the U.S. headquarters lets us have use of. It's not free. It costs us $57,000 a year that we pay to U.S. headquarters. We do try and maintain strict accountability and not fudge any of this because we are distinct. We're spending $21,000 this year on fundraising because we've got to balance that budget, and we spend $3,000 or so on hosting the IoT conference twice a year. $373,000, and you add on a couple of staff, Paul Ronka and Hugh Harris, who are staying on the area system, which encourages us, and you've got $433,000 expenditure. So that is an overview of international headquarters, and more important than how it's financed or who's in it, just to go back to page 20, I'm sorry, page 23. Our purpose, what we want and strive and try and pray to do, is to serve Lorne and his leadership team, and then, somewhat more indirectly in the nature of things, the NAV staff around the world. And I am personally very pleased with the development in IHQ that has taken place over the last year, and with the amount of opportunity we see to do things even better in the years ahead. I just feel that we've got a good team now, and we're moving ahead well. I will stop there. It is precisely 12:15. I have not allowed the time for interaction. I apologize for that. Perhaps we can do some of that over lunch.